You have tuned in to an encore presentation of Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM. Thanks so much for listening. It's Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris with your host, Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson. From KMRE's American Carnage Report, legislative and electoral expert Dave Willingham, and also tonight, City Councilman Dan Hamill. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We have so much to talk about tonight. Whatcom County Jail, homelessness, housing, and filing week, part one, the county edition. But first, let's start with a couple of quick hits, including the county council meeting that went till midnight last night.
Yes, this was another meeting on the Cherry Point amendments. Nothing much changed, I think. There was the same number of people there that were complaining about why are you trying to kill jobs, other people thanking the council for expanding the number of things that the council, that future councils can look at as they do land determinations for that area. And I guess the way I would characterize it is, you know, there's a saying that when all you have in the toolbox is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And for 50 years, the only thing that's been in the Cherry Point toolbox has been refining operations. And then what they did was they just added some more tools to the toolbox so that they can think about other sorts of industries that could go there and also have some parameters to possibly limit the kinds of businesses that they do not want to see there go there.
So we've talked about this before on the show, especially when we had County Councilman Carl Weimer, but what specifically, if you want to just have a quick recap of what some of those amendments entailed specifically?
Well, they're hard to characterize in specifics, but they're vision statements for the county's comprehensive plan. So some things in the past had been subordinated to other things. You know, in the past, it was industrial growth. And in the new amendments, they allow for things like historical use, for environmental concerns, for fisheries, for all these things that go into, that can go into a more circumspect examination of proposals that come to that area in the future.
So this was a pretty rowdy meeting, I heard, and the open comment period went for a long time. As you said, the public comments sort of fell along those lines of environment versus jobs and protection of jobs.
And so did the vote, because the vote was 6-1, as it has been throughout.
And was it Brenner?
The one that's out. And, you know, I think she got convinced by the petroleum industry and the petroleum interests out there that this sent a bad signal that they weren't welcome. But it actually doesn't change anything that's ongoing out at Cherry Point. It does have some statements about a kind of activity, and when Carl was on the show, he went through this a little bit, but the kind of activity that would allow for the export of unrefined fuels. And, you know, the question there for county council is always that, you know, the exporting of unrefined fossil fuels, and the emphasis on unrefined, doesn't create a lot of jobs. You turn a valve, you fill a ship, and it goes to China, and it gets refined there. So, I think that the concerns about this sends a bad message about jobs, I think, is a little overblown.
And Councilman Hamill, this is not your bailiwick. I don't know if you have an opinion on what's going on with Cherry Point. You're welcome to give it.
You know, I wasn't at the meeting last night. I did hear that it went pretty long. I think that we have to have consideration around treaty rights, for sure, environmental protections, and job creation. But I think it has to be done well. And, industrial jobs are important. But I think that there are other ways to look at this in terms of high paying tech jobs that we could have on our waterfront. So I think there's other ways that we could come at this approach and thinking about the big context, not just Cherry Point. But I do stand by those treaty rights for Lummi and how it could affect Nooksack. So that's my perspective.
But Bellingham also had they had a stake in this too, because what we're talking about in terms of unrefined fossil fuels is moving train traffic through the city of Bellingham that's volatile, possibly dangerous. But the city of Bellingham sort of stepped back and did not get involved in this and did not send a letter pro or con about the Cherry Point amendments. Is that correct?
That's correct. I think that we as a council and perhaps mayor's office are missing on this one. I think that this does affect Bellingham residents for sure. When our firefighters tell us that it's kind of impossible for them to tell what's inside that tank car and what spilled when it got knocked over, that's an issue for Bellingham.
It all interrelates, and that is a great segue, fortunately or unfortunately, into the issue of the county jail, which is sort of the poster child of how the county and the city of Bellingham interrelate. And Tim has been talking about the plans and that there might be some proposals moving forward. Councilman Hamill, do you want to sort of give us an update on where we are?
Sure. So the last council meeting we were put before us was a jail facilities use agreement. And it's a little different than last time. Last time was 521 beds. We were asked to Bellingham was asked to contribute at a rate that was much higher than what our actual use was. The deal was much more expensive. This time, it's a little bit less expensive. The beds are 440 plus or minus 3% with 36 medical beds. So that's up to 489 beds. Bellingham is being asked to contribute 15.8% to the capital side of the project. And then, of course, we'd pay a per diem and a booking charge on top of that. So right now it's $108 per day, and it's $100 to book a person into the current facility. So our actual use historically for the past several years has been an average of 13.44%. So we're being asked to contribute about 2.5 points more than what we actually use. I own a business, and I watch every penny that goes in and out of the door. And so for us to ask the taxpayers, which it's not our money, it's the taxpayers' money, to contribute at a higher rate, I have a problem with that. I also question whether or not we are at a point where we can even know what the size of the jail should be, because we have not gone through an analysis of, for example, our electronic home monitoring program, which is just over a year old. We've reduced the jail population by 25%. We've saved Bellingham taxpayers over $300,000.
And that home monitoring system is Bellingham exclusively, not for the whole county?
The county has an EHM program, but it's very underutilized. It's much more expensive to the cost of the county because of the types of units that they use. We work with a nonprofit called Friendship Diversion Services, and our cost per unit is about $14.50 per day. And we subsidize the cost of that, and it's over twice that for the county because of the type of system that they use. So that's one example. EHM, electronic home monitoring, is one example of how we've driven our misdemeanor population down. And that, just so people know, the county is responsible for felons. So if you're a Bellingham person, you commit a felony, the county is responsible for you in the jail. If you're a Bellingham person, you commit a misdemeanor, Bellingham is responsible for you. So that means that right now we're on booking restrictions depending on what time of day it is, basically. And if we're on booking restrictions, it makes it very hard for our officers to have a choice in terms of what to do with this person who's committed some type of misdemeanor type crime.
Let me just clarify quickly. When you say, I understand a misdemeanor versus a felony, but explain why the time of day then becomes relevant in terms of when you can and cannot book.
It has to do with the jail population. And so typically the jail population is busiest from Thursday through Saturday night, roughly speaking. And of course, there can be spikes and dips and things like that throughout the week. But we are at a capacity, the jail, pardon me, is at a capacity of 212 people. And when we hit that number, when the sheriff's department hits that number, they tell our police that they're no longer accepting misdemeanors. And so our options are very limited at that point. We could book a person and take them to Yakima. We're doing pretrial now. That's not my favorite at all. I've driven to Yakima. I've interviewed Bellingham prisoners down there. They like that facility much better than the Whatcom County Jail because it's much less crowded. But and we have taken measures where we have hired a defense attorney in Yakima. We have a contract. There's a Skype type system that people can use to communicate with their families. So there is that. But it's not the same. It's not the same as being in this community. So we're in this very tense situation where we need to have some type of facility. We know that. We also want to have alternatives, but we haven't been able to thoroughly examine them. We have a new program called GRACE, Ground Level Response and Coordinated Engagement, that many folks have met with each other, the sheriff, the police chief, attorneys, case managers, electeds. And this model is based on CHART, which is Chronic High Utilizer Alternate Response Team out of Everett. We are not the only folks that have people who use our services in a way that's like too frequent and inappropriate. So people that use our emergency department or jail, have contact with police officers, have contact with fire and courts. The idea is to lessen those contacts through diversion programs. But we don't have, that program has not left the ground yet. So how can we say 440 beds is the right amount when we haven't thoroughly studied things that haven't happened yet, and also programs that have, but we don't have a lot of data. So that's where I'm having the hang up with it.
Right. And Dan, I just to sort of unpack for listeners a little bit, you've expressed quite a bit of skepticism about the jail use agreement moving forward on council, but you also have been very heavily involved in the Incarceration Alternatives Task Force, and you're the city's liaison on that. And so your skepticism comes based upon a lot of the things that you've been talking about. You've gone to Yakima, you've done your homework on these issues, and I wonder if you can talk about the work you've done on that Alternative Incarcerations Task Force and how that's informed you and your thinking on the jail.
Sure. Well, part of my experience was traveling to different communities to understand how they're looking at their criminal justice reform system or reforming their system. The first place I went to was Spokane, where you had prosecutors and defense attorneys and people who normally didn't sit at the same table, but they were at the same table because they were able to secure a MacArthur Foundation grant. So it was there that I really started to kind of dive into alternatives. So community court, Judge Mary Logan in Spokane operates a community court, very similar to this GRACE program that I just mentioned. And that it deals with people's issues, and so it deals with the person and to a greater degree than the crime. And so then we can get to the root cause of why that person is committing the crime, and therefore hopefully that person won't be doing that again.
So when you say the person instead of the crime, are you talking about sort of a more holistic view of the person and what their circumstances are and putting them in context of their circumstances or mental health or give me more.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And those are, yeah, absolutely. So mental health illness is a cause of why people can get tangled up in the criminal justice system. Substance use disorder, another cause. Whatcom County is very high up there. I think we're number 3 and number 4 for hospitalization treatment for opiate and heroin. And so we have a crisis here, and that's causing property crime and other types of crime. So if we can get at that person's addiction and illness and get that treated, then we have a better opportunity to not have them in our very expensive criminal justice system. So on the task force, I served on the Legal and Justice Committee. So I sat at the table with commissioners and judges and prosecutors and attorneys to work on the legal end of things. And now I switched over to the Behavioral Health Committee. So I'm committee hopping around to try to figure out how can we solve these issues? There's also a triage facility as well, and that committee has recommended a 16-bed mental health treatment triage and a 16-bed co-located substance use disorder treatment facility. And the reason it's 16 is because Medicaid won't fund past 16. They think it's an institution. And so we have an opportunity here to have a good diversion place that people can go. And that's one thing that I'm learning that we're lacking in our community. We lack those detox beds, absolutely. We lack clean and sober housing for people that are, for example, returning from prison or jail. They don't have a place to go. And that's one contributing factor to the homeless issue I know that we're going to be discussing here in a bit.
With the process that the new jail has been under in this recent incarnation, it seems like there have been a couple of different tracks. There's been the diversion and alternatives committee. There was the committee to determine how to pay for it, and the what the jail would look like was its own separate process, and that seems really bizarre to me. Am I off base? Shouldn't that all be integrated into a larger, this is what we're going to do, instead of broken into separate tracks?
Yes, that's an astute observation. I think that that's one problem that local government is not very good at, is integrating those types of thinking into a broader context, and we're just not. We're not seeing that, and I think Bellingham, City of Bellingham government, I think does a really good job. And I'm biased. I work, you know, I work for the City of Bellingham government. I think that the county government is a slightly more siloed, in my opinion, and that I think is just because of the way the structure works with that government. But I think that if you combine those committees and you worked or those types of committees, and if they work together, then we could achieve better change faster, in my opinion.
Well, so I know that there's a contingent. You were talking about the size of the jail, and 440 beds seems more reasonable than 521 beds. And then there's a whole echelon of our city that doesn't think that that we need to expand any beds, or that any size has been too big. But in the meantime, you're talking about these programs like GRACE and alternatives, and I am worried that our city can't afford it. And when we look at what's happening on the state level, and I think we are still in special session and not even able to fund education, I just have a lot of fears, because I don't think that state safety net still exists for mental health programs or substance use programs or detox programs. So where's the city going with that?
Well, I think a lot of that depends on McCleary, on the education decision that's going to be coming through. And I agree that we have not prioritized mental health as much as we could. So it's beds, housing, treatment. Those are the three things, both on the mental health side and on the substance use disorder side. With GRACE, there are other funding opportunities through Medicaid potentially that could be sourced through the Medicaid expansion. But given the instability of our federal government at this point, I don't know what that looks like. I'm hopeful and I'm confident based on some evidence that I've has been presented to me that funding for GRACE could be there. But that's just one program. So we need a lot more than just one program. I think that the hospital does a good job at involuntary commitment beds. I think that we need more of them. We need a place for our officers to take a person when they're acting out or aggressive, that kind of thing. But then where do we take a person who has dementia and that person struck their wife? What's an appropriate response for that? Is it the jail for a person who's mentally ill, who's impaired, and has done something where that person harmed another individual? So I think we need to think about those things. And we have an aging population that's not going to go away. It's probably going to increase. We have the silver tsunami of baby boomers that are cresting. And so, you know, I think that's a real thing, though. I think we need to be thinking about options for our police and for pre-arrest diversion for our HOT team, for our homeless outreach team. You know, where can they help a person get to for treatment or housing or you know, the basic needs, the basic nuts and bolts of life?
But I hear that voice in my head saying, "Who's going to pay for it?"
Absolutely. That's the voice. And maybe it's not your voice that keeps me up at night, but it's a voice that keeps me up at night. And it all does come down to funding. Absolutely. And the city is not. And does not have an endless pile of cash that it can pull from. I don't know if people think that, but that's absolutely not true. We're pipes, lights, and roads and parks, and we try to do some programming. We try to assist our partners in the nonprofit community, and also our new partner, Lighthouse Mission, for our homeless housing.
And this instrument that they're looking at, this taxing instrument to build a jail, there is a component of that that comes back to the city. So it actually does yield the city some money to approach some of these problems. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I'm still trying to get the actual number. I think it depends on who I talk to. I get a different number, but it's around $1 million. You know, I was talking with a rank-and-file police guild president today, and we talked about that issue, that pot of money. So what could that go towards? That's public safety dollars. So we have fire and police, and we could probably do some type of, you know, mental health something maybe. And I don't know quite what that looks like. We need a new police station. The one that we have is not sufficient to meet the needs of our police department. If we expand into the Alderwood UGA, for example, we immediately incur costs. And so if we're hiring additional firefighters,
UGA being,
I'm sorry, I shouldn't speak in acronym lingo.
I'm here to ask those acronym questions every single week.
So our urban growth area. So Bellingham has a ring of urban growth areas that surround our city that we can grow into. And plan development makes sense, but it costs money. And so this extra million dollars a year that we would get back, that taxpayers are, they're paying into this, right? Could go towards a new fire station, a new police station, but it's only $1 million. So how much does a new fire station cost? More than $1 million. So, right. And if we are contractually bound, which we are, to hire firefighters and police officers as we expand, because we need to do those things. Firefighters are $100,000 a year, and police officers are $110,000 a year. So that $1 million goes away pretty quickly. So. Yes, we do get – we have about $1 million that comes back to Bellingham. We could use it for creative, interesting diversion, alternative intervention strategies, but we also have the needs of a growing population. So to me, that's – you know, it appears to be like this poison pill that a politician could swallow, but if you peel it back a little bit, it's really not that much money.
This is sort of leading into some other questions, obviously, that we're always addressing and trying to figure out. Homelessness and housing are two biggest lodestones around our neck. But one quick question in the jail, not to put you on the spot too much, but I hear that you have some reservations. What I read from Mayor Linville, it sounded like she was at least entertaining the idea. What is your take on the rest of council? Do you have a sense of how they're feeling?
I don't want to speak for the rest of council. I don't know where they're at. I really don't. And we're in the middle of this process. The last time it was presented to us, it was for what's called information only. And this time it looks like provide direction, which would be change this, you know, X that out, make some kind of adjustments. And then the third time it'll come before us, it's for a vote. And so the rest of the council, like myself, we're all kind of trying to, look at this, examine it, and spend time talking to people. I've talked with the police chief, talked with Police Guild President April Mitchelson today, and I've got a phone call scheduled tomorrow with our fire chief. So I'm doing my due diligence on this to try to figure out where are they coming from? What are their needs going to be? I want to understand their perspective.
And if I could characterize where I think most council people are at, just watching, they've had a lot more questions answered, and the answers that they've received have been better.
Yeah.
And I think that how you might characterize it at this point.
So the next step is that the city council votes, and then does it come up before? Would it go back on the ballot?
So we would vote on what's called the jail facility use agreement. So basically it's like an interlocal agreement between the – it's our contract with the county for the use of the jail, basically. And then it would go to the county council. And so other small cities would do the same, too. So if Ferndale, Blaine, others would also vote on this. Their councils would vote on it. And then it goes to county council. County council then determines whether it goes in front of voters on November, whatever the date is in November for Election Day.
Fair enough. And I'm sure Councilman Hamill would join me in inviting the public to reach out to the city council and weigh in, because I'm sure that doesn't happen often enough.
We definitely encourage people to, and we had some folks that came last time. And what was unfortunate was that a lot of facts weren't correct, or things that were being said were not based in fact. The size was, we had several people say, three different sizes, and none of them were correct. So, I don't know. I guess looking at the city council pack is one way to take a look and at the jail facility use agreement that we had that was before us. That's a great way to kind of become informed, and it's a little wonky. But I encourage people if they have questions to contact me, and I'm happy to try to answer those questions or get those questions answered.
Thank you. You are tuned to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contours, and our guest is Councilman Dan Hamill, who has asked for you to reach out. And I'm sure all of your city council representatives would really like to hear from you about this matter, and you should go and read some of those documents. And our co-hosts are Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham, and we just have a couple minutes left in this half of the hour, but I thought I would ask you, since you're here. It seemed pretty disappointing, the whole situation with the port, and what I think that may be more the mayor's office issue now, but what happens in terms of city council and our ongoing homelessness problem?
That's a great question. The port, well, the Bellingham city-owned property at 801 and 807 Roeder is now going to be bought by the port. They had their right of first refusal, basically, or right of right first of or option of first refusal. And they have spent $780,000 buying two buildings that need extensive repairs. So it was kind of a letdown. I mean, we were ready and prepared to invest $300,000 in marine trades. There was a plan to, you know, cut a hole in the back of the tissue paper warehouse big enough for those businesses to take boats in and out of, which they have to have access to the inside to do the work, and also to the crane that's on the waterfront. That crane's critical. There are only three of them in Bellingham. There's one in Fairhaven and then two down in the port area. So, and we want those marine trades jobs. We want those jobs here because they're good paying jobs. People can buy houses. They can raise families because of those jobs. So we wanted to make that investment. And unfortunately, it came down to one vote on the port commission. Port commission is only three people. Unlike city council, which is seven. So it did come down to one vote, unfortunately. And I'm just really disappointed that that those investments weren't made in marine trades and that we didn't get the location for the shelter, which is desperately needed. We're at 719 people who are unsheltered homeless right now. We're up steadily from 2012. And the root cause of this is real simple. I just want to make this really clear. So the Department of Commerce have studied this issue backwards and forwards. And every time the rents in a community go up by $100, homelessness goes up between 6% and 32%.
Wow.
So they've studied it over and over and over. I went back and looked at the data, and we're right in there. So 2015, we're up by 18%. 2016, I believe, is up by 12%. And then this year, we're going up, but it's not as much. So that's the root cause, and Bellingham is a desirable community. West Coast communities in general are experiencing this because they're desirable mm-hmm. communities. So people are moving here, rents go up. People at the fringes, those with that are harder to house, that have barriers to housing, they tend to become homeless then, and that's exactly what's going on here.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you on there, Dan, because you've sort of in your time on council made yourself a mini expert on a lot of these things: incarceration alternatives, homelessness, affordable housing, and you have just sketched for us the relationship between affordability and homelessness. It's kind of counterintuitive, this idea that, well, you know, if you build nice things for homeless people, they'll just come to town. It kind of suggests that the homeless people are here and they're being displaced because of the lack of affordable housing. What do you think can be done about that issue?
First of all, the thing that you're describing is called the magnet theory. That, you know, if you have resources and services and things like that, then people gravitate here. So we know that through our point in time count, that 70% of people are locals and they're being displaced because they can't afford to pay rent, basically, and that 30% are from somewhere else and may have lived here before, maybe not. And that's very consistent up and down the West Coast. In point in time counts that are done in other communities, it's the same thing. So, you know, I don't think that we should stop delivering excellent services to our community. I don't think that we should stop being compassionate people. I think that we should continue to do those things. And that's not going to draw, that's not the reason people are, that we see people downtown. The reason we see people downtown is because their rent is too high. And when that happens, people get marginalized. So, you know, I think that building affordable housing is the answer. And so we were very fortunate in this community to pass a housing levy in 2012 that created a pipeline of housing. And now we're starting to see that where people like Mercy or organizations like Mercy Housing and Catholic Housing Services have started to show the value of their work. So look at Francis Place. That was not a housing levy. That was pre-housing levy dollars. But Eleanor Apartments certainly is. And that's at the corner of the old, across from the Planned Parenthood and BGO, Bellingham Grocery Outlet.
Right. I hope that everybody knows what BGO stands for, but you don't know.
Yeah. So the 80 units of affordable housing for seniors who are at half of the area median income, so poor, and then 30% of the area median income. So very, very poor individuals. Can you imagine a person, you know, you yourself going through life and near the end of your life, the last 15, 20 years, you're homeless. I mean, that's terrible. So, so we have these options now because of the pipeline.
Wow. And you are tuned to Cascadia News Now, and we are going to have more with Councilman Dan Hamill right after this.
wants to electrify your spring break with fun demonstrations and activities to explore sound, electricity, magnetism, and robotics. Spring break hours are 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Wednesday through Friday, April 5th, 6th, and 7th, with demonstrations scattered throughout each day. The nonprofit Spark Museum is located at 1312 Bay Street in downtown Bellingham, with a mission to get kids excited about science. Visit sparkmuseum.org for more information.
You know, Miles, Muddy, and Mongo are gone from this earth, but remain a presence in the present with Hacksaw Jazz.
Jazz and blues from RadioPhoenix.org. This is Full Moon Hacksaw.
Yes, chords and scales, but also lyrics and melody. It's Hacksaw Jazz with you Sundays at 8 and Wednesdays at 9 p.m. on KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham, Washington.
Jazz and blues, Full Moon Hacksaw.
You are tuned to KMRE FM 102.3 FM in Bellingham. I'm Stephanie Contouris, and you're listening to Cascadia News Now with me, Dave Willingham, Tim Johnson, and our special guest, City Councilman Dan Hamill. And we were just talking about the port vote, which sort of leads us into the big exciting news of the week when we are smack dab in the middle of filing week. For those of you who don't know what filing week is, it is the week that people who have been saying that they were going to run for office are actually registering to run for office. And since we were just talking about the port, let's start by taking a look at the port districts. As you said, there's only three port commissioners. It's certainly been opined before in Bellingham that there should be more than three. But in the meantime, three is what we have. So I believe that there are are they all three up, Tim?
No, two are
just
up.
Just two are up. Mm-hmm. So we have incumbent Dan Robbins, who voted against the Rotor Home deal that you were just talking about. And he is running against Michael Alvarez Shepherd, and I just know a little bit about him. He's a Western Washington University guy. He's a professor, environmental studies and cultural and environmental sustainability professor. He's associated with the Center for Pacific Northwest Studies. He is also an environmental and First Nations consultant. So what a fascinating perspective. I don't know anything about him. I don't know if anybody else does or wants to weigh in.
Mm-hmm. I'll weigh in a bit.
Okay, but fair enough. But all I have to say, never heard of him before, but man, that is quite a resume.
Absolutely.
And at the very least, somebody who works with First Nations people, both here and in BC, and who teaches and has his mind on environmental issues and also sustainability, would be a great perspective if he at all knows his stuff. Also, just announced today, Nicholas Kunkel, who had originally run for city council for a minute, I think, a couple of years back, and just checked in with him briefly today. He said he is running on sustainable nonprofit fisheries advocacy.
Yes. And, you know, Nick is a self-professed libertarian, small L. And that means that I think that he will focus on the port's central mission of economic development and economics. And, you know, I guess I'd rather speak about the whole slate of port commissioners. But it's interesting because we're going to have two primaries in this election for the port. And I think one of the reasons why you're seeing that is because the current port commission has been pretty excellent.
When you say two primaries, you mean that both districts are going to have
both
a primary,
districts have
right.
more than two candidates right. running for them. Mm-hmm. In fact, the second seat that you're about to talk about, District
or
2.
Or you can go ahead, right?
District 2 is an open seat, and that almost always generates some interest. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be an interesting election this year for a couple of reasons. We redistricted to five districts for the county. But the port is not redistricted. It is on the old districting system. So it has three districts, one commissioner for each district.
Doesn't match the county at all anymore.
Doesn't match the yeah. county template at all. And they're county-wide positions. And I guess I will let you introduce the second
sure.
team. But the one thing the emphasis I would make is that to this point, they've been a real blue-collar commission, and they've really focused their activities and their energy on marine use and working waterfront and jobs. And it's a different kind of commission than we've seen in the past that was kind of a little bit more white-collar, thinking about
development
thinking about condominiums and that kind of thing. These guys are like, they roll up their sleeves and work, and it's an interesting group to see. And it's just an interesting slate.
So getting to the second half of this slate, it was Mike McCauley's seat. If you had been listening to our show last week, you would have heard, or a couple weeks ago actually, that he feels like he has done enough. And he has certainly worked hard on the port, but his District 2 is open, and that's the open seat. So Doug Carlberg, Barry Winger, and Ken Bell. And Ken Bell did run before.
He did.
And he lost. And he also was a walk planning commissioner in the past. He says that he wants mixed business. He is sort of resigned about coal issues, and the Global Pacific, at least as he's talked about in the past, has been his stance. I know nothing about Doug Carlberg or Barry Winger. Anybody else?
Yes, I know both of them very, very well. And Doug Carlberg is a fisherman. He's another one of those guys that rolls up his sleeves and gets to work. I've got some very strong opinions about the direction the port should make. He would make a powerful commissioner in association with Bobby Briscoe, who is also on the commission. So he would make a very powerful addition to that in terms of keeping that focus where it belongs. Barry he is the water expert guy for Whatcom County, worked for the Department of Ecology for many years, huge environmental understanding and focus. He was the person Ecology relied on for their the information they understood about Whatcom Waterway. So he would just be an unbelievably potent and powerful person to put on the commission. I mean, it would be, you'd have suddenly technical expertise on the commission about many of the things that the commission is going to be
pursuing. Not that you're endorsing.
I think those two are wonderful candidates. Ken Bell, he also has a real focus on jobs. He's a working man, you know, and so. You know, I've said this in the past that, you know, I'm a liberal, but the Port Commission, in my mind, they don't have to be liberals. They just have
That's what the other city governments
for. They just,
we're all nodding at Councilman Hamill.
They have to have a good sense of the community and where the community's future lies. The current commission, I think, it just been great about understanding that we're a maritime community. Fishing represents about 8% of the jobs related, and fishing and related industries about 8% of the jobs in Whatcom County. So I think that they've been great, and it would be great to see that tradition continue.
You know, the big question for me is, for all five of these candidates, and I think you hit it when you said good sense, is do any of them think that a good use of $750,000 of their budget is to buy some teardown?
Yeah.
And I really think that's going to be overshadowing a lot of this, is the continued debate over that, because I think that was a poor decision.
It was a huge mistake. I'll say it. Yeah.
And I think that's gonna color the entire race.
And I can imagine those questions will be asked at panels
repeatedly.
Yes, repeatedly. Remind us, who is the District 3 Port Commissioner?
It is Bobby Briscoe.
Bobby Briscoe, who was the most, wasn't he the most adamant?
He was absolutely
the trade.
Yeah, he would. Yeah. His foot was down, and it stayed down. But and his position on it was pretty blunt, that he has seen too much port property given away. And squandered and given to non-marine uses, and he's not going to do it. And he ran on that as a when he ran for port commissioner, and he's sticking to it. He that can make him a thorny character, but I have to say, you know, his values are in place, and he knows what they are, and he will tell you what they are.
But it's good for, I mean, the way that I think about it is that I want. I always want a diversity of perspectives, regardless of whether it's a county council or city council report. So knowing that Briscoe is still there, then that makes me look with a different eye at some of the people who are running, because I don't want repeated Briscoes when each vote, as Councilman Hamill pointed out, each vote carries one third of the decision as opposed to more numerous voices. And just briefly, I seem to recall some, and I think it was Commissioner McCauley who once brought up the question of going to five. And was that a vote? Did we have that as a vote, or was it just discussion?
We have had it as a discussion. I think that it didn't get onto a ballot. If it did, it failed. Here's the dynamic. When you like the commission and they're doing what you like them to be three.
Because, right.
And when they're not doing what you like, you want them to be five, because you're thinking, in my own thought about it is that I think groups of people make better decisions when there are larger groups of people. And one of the problems with the commission currently is they actually cannot even legally speak to one another without it being a quorum.
Right.
So you can't call up your fellow commissioner on the phone and
well, he gets into collusion.
Hear him out about something. You can't. I mean, in other words, you know, Michael McCauley, who voted for this thing, was not able to contact Bobby Briscoe and try to talk him out of his position. They had to do it right up there. And it's a very dynamic thing. But at times, you know, it would be nice to be able to sit down and have coffee with someone that you're going to make a decision with. You know,
I hear you, but at the same time, if two people go out and have coffee, it could be considered to be collusion.
Well, it's not a collusion if two city council people go out, for example, because there's seven of them.
Right. And collusion is, you know, in certain types of collusion are politics. That's what happens. That's how deals get worked out. You know, if I, you know, see somebody in a grocery store and I think I better go to that next aisle because of the, you know, Open Meetings Act, that's a little different. The three-member thing is really constraining.
And the commission, you know, if they wanted to make things a little smoother, they could easily go to a five-district commission and use the template of five districts the county now has. It's a little wonky now that the port uses one map to do its thing,
and the county uses another
based upon redistricting.
And we're going to get into that, but I want to ask Councilman Hamill, from your position on the city council, what type of person might you like to see, or what type of position might you like to see represented on the port?
On the port? Yeah. Well, I think that there is this marine trade growth that we've experienced. Like Tim was saying, that's about 8% of the economy. Accounts for a lot of jobs in the community. So I think that growing that versus putting in more capacity for yachts, I think I would favor, you know, more marine trades. But I think a diversity of opinions, I think technical expertise is important. I think understanding environmental concerns and having some history with the port property and with the waterfront is important as well to bring that perspective. We've had a waterfront that's sat fallow for years and years. And I think people want access to it. I think people want to get moving. They want us as a city to work with the port to get things moving on that property. And I think that Michael Shepard's got that vision in terms of working towards getting public access. Let's get people down there. Let's get some residential development. Let's get some commercial development. The city's putting in a park this coming year. The granary building is you know, kind of almost up and running. So, you know, so things are happening down there, but they're not happening at the speed that I think people want to see. So I think the leadership in getting development that's reflective of our community, I think that's what we need to see in a port commissioner.
That's great and succinct. And we don't have a lot of time, so let's get into the county council. So far, and I did not refresh at 4:30, so I don't have the absolute latest, but as of 3 p.m. today, in District 1, Rudd Brown, still unopposed. Anybody anticipate that changing?
I haven't heard anything, and he's got quite a war chest left over, so I would be surprised if he went totally unopposed, but I don't think he's going to see a lot of real heavy opposition.
Fair enough. Amy Glasser, who sort of filed with the PDC, the Public Disclosure Commission, a couple months ago and has been all over town, and you've probably seen billboards with glasses on them, with a somewhat surprise challenger of Todd Donovan, who is in a different position now in the in the current configuration is sort of jumping over to the new District 2 to run against Amy Glasser. Also, Daniel Kolick, who is a plumber, Dan the plumber, his press release says he wants to learn from people who are already involved. District 3, which is the foothills, and in the new configuration, conventional wisdom seems to think that that's the more conservative balance to the more District 2 is North Bellingham. Amy Glasser and Todd Donovan both pretty far into the progressive at the very least. So in the foothills, we have Tyler Bird, who's endorsed by Sam Crawford and Chet Dow, and Cliff Langley. Cliff had run, and I think he was on the Charter Commission. Was he on the Charter Commission, I think?
Maybe. Yeah, I believe.
And when he ran for that position, his issues, again, this is a previous candidacy, but he had said that he cared about defending property from, quote, unjust appropriations, and he was against specific beliefs or interests, and government oversteps its intended function, which might be representative of a certain echelon of the foothills. But also, there had been a rumor that Sat Pal Sidhu might run, and I haven't seen him file yet. Those are the basics in the districts. That we also have the at-large, which is Barry Buchanan, is running for that position against Mary Kay Robinson, who is sort of our compatriot over at KGMI, as well as a realtor.
I'm really excited for District 3 because it is one of the, it is the collection of the least predictable precincts in Whatcom County. It goes all the way down from the waterline in the southwest of the county, wraps up around Bellingham, includes Geneva and Sudden Valley, goes around Bellingham and Lake Whatcom up Meridian a little bit until you're at Van Dyke, then out east and skirts around Everson and Nooksack and Sumas. It's going to be really, really difficult to run a campaign out there, and I'm kind of excited to see what comes out of it.
Well, I'm kind of excited about the county races, period, because I think they're going to be, it's going to be a car wreck. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I say that is because when they did the redistricting, they tried to do the districts in a very intelligent way, and that was somewhat heedless of what of the districts as they currently exist. They tried to keep them cohesive and sensible, et cetera. But in District 2, you have three sitting county council members currently that are all in collision. Mm-hmm. Sat Pal Sidhu, Barry Buchanan, Todd Donovan are all in collision in District 2. And so
in the current District
2. That's why Todd is running again. That's why we don't know what Sat Pal Sidhu is going to do, because is Sat Pal going to run or is he not going to run in this race? And that's why Barry Buchanan.
Let me just interject with
Sat
Pal Sidhu. If he does not jump into District 3, his district disappears.
That's why I say it's going to be, it's a little bit of a car wreck in District 2. We have these three people who are on council now that are having to adjust what they're doing. Todd Donovan wasn't supposed to be up for election, but now he's running because he has to run in order to be viable in his district. And Barry Buchanan, he has to be in a different position too because he's not in his former district anymore. So that's a big mess. But I agree with what you say about District 3. That's the foothills. It's a very it's geographically large, but it's very rural, and it's not necessarily the farming district the way the central farming district. So it's going to be fun, and one of the things that makes it fun is that each one of these is district only, and so only the people in the district are able to vote for these candidates, except for the at-large.
And that's
positions.
Not how it has been in the past, which is part of the reason that I think that the Charter Commission came up with this compromise. And so the idea is, instead of everybody picking everybody, that the people who are more in the city and maybe have more city values, you could look at it that way. But it comes into a sort of progressive vote and a conservative vote. However, I neglected to mention a surprise announcement last night from Rebecca Boonstra, who I hadn't heard of, but she's from Maple Falls, which is already exciting because I don't know that we've ever had any representative, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, from Kendall or the Maple Falls area. So to start, Maple Falls, she's connected with the Opportunity Council and been on a whole bunch of boards. And I don't know. I don't know how she qualified she is. I don't know what happened. But the idea of somebody even representing that group of people is so exciting.
Yeah, she is the progressive and in a race that's got a lot of right-wingers running in it, you know, and fierce right-wingers.
That's the best part is now you have these areas like Geneva and Kendall and all of that where they become the center of gravity, whereas in the previous districts, Bellingham was the center of gravity, even for the districts that just didn't have a lot of Bellingham in them. It was always, are you the Bellingham candidate or are you the outside Bellingham candidate? And this really, I mean, even the other districts like the one that includes Ferndale and West, Ferndale is going to be the center there, and it's very exciting.
And we're going to talk about this more for part two of Filing Week when Filing Week ends next Wednesday, so tune in. And we're just going to wrap up with a bit of an announcement and an interview with Iris Monty Gibson from the Whatcom Dispute Resolution Center. She's got some information about a couple of events that they're putting on.
Part of Project Connection, and they will be a 2-hour workshop followed by a 1-hour facilitated conversation exploring equity and cultural humility. And that's a topic that we explore in our adult conflict resolution education program at the WDRC. But what we're finding is that more people across Whatcom County are both interested in this topic and often have a lack of an opportunity to engage in it. And so in this time of heightened lack of trust and challenging community divides, we felt that bringing this workshop and facilitated conversation out into the county, particularly outside of Bellingham, where so often these events take place, will make these opportunities for conversation and connection more accessible to the broader Whatcom County.
Tell me more about that. You said we're having this in the county. The first one's in Ferndale, and the second one is in Maple Falls, Kendall area. What do you mean these events tend to take place?
Well, many of our nonprofits here in Whatcom County are located in Bellingham, and a lot of times funding for these programs as well are from businesses right inside Bellingham. And with so many programs happening in Bellingham and so many opportunities to connect with neighbors happening within Bellingham, it makes a lot of programs hard to get to, both transportation-wise, how people are hearing about them. Also, something that was really important to us is that Whatcom County, so many people think that Bellingham and Whatcom County lacks diversity. In reality, there are a number of communities within Whatcom County that are diverse in language, ethnicity, cultural heritage, and oftentimes I think they may be left out of the traditional modes of outreach for these types of community events that nonprofits put on. And so our goal not only was to bring these events physically outside of Bellingham and reach communities across Whatcom County, but also to find new ways for us to connect with and open lines of communication to communities that might often be left out of the conversation.
So you're talking about it as a way to connect with different communities and work on or approach or answer some curiosity about cultural issues and cultural dynamics. Unpack that for me a little bit. What will happen? What will it be like if I go to this event?
Well, like I said, there'll be a 2-hour workshop facilitated by Masa Dallara, who is a very skilled trainer. You can find her bio on our website. She's trained in what's called the REACH Network, she focuses on adverse childhood experiences, resilience in communities who've experienced trauma, and in culture and diversity awareness. And so the workshop will not only help people understand their own cultural heritage, identity, appreciation for where they're coming from, but also get an understanding of an appreciation for other cultural heritage and ethnicities, identities, and kind of an understanding of how to honor and create space that is open for people of different values and backgrounds.
So when I hear workshop, I imagine some people might be thinking, oh, it's a diversity workshop. And if somebody's been to a diversity workshop, is this worthwhile? How will it be different?
Absolutely. And I think that's a good question as well, and that we want people to be aware that this workshop is very accessible to folks of all backgrounds and experience levels with content around diversity and equity. And so it will both be accessible to a high school age student and their parents who may have had no experience having conversations about cultural heritage and ethnicity and race issues, and as well for people who have delved into race and cultural heritage in different, either in school or in their community in other workshops. There'll be something for everyone. And Masa's done a really great job at all of her workshops in tailoring the workshop to who's in the room. And so while we're not requesting RSVPs for the workshop, there'll be an opportunity in the beginning to understand who's there, what types of backgrounds and levels of experience are present in the room, and the conversation and workshop will be tailored to who's present.
That sounds really inviting, and I appreciate that. My next question is, if I want to know, say I want to know more about my neighbors, I want to know about my Nooksack and Lummi neighbors or our immigrant community, but I feel really uncomfortable and I'm a little bit scared about maybe being put on the spot.
One thing that I've really liked about Masa's workshop, I've been there too, of that, I would much rather stay in bed on a Saturday than go get uncomfortable about my privilege and hear things that it might make me feel go outside of my comfort zone. But this experience is so worthwhile, and that what Masa does is not only gives a lot of personal time for reflection and internalizing the activities and lessons, but also there's some time for some partner sharing. But there's not a lot of those group activities or required sharing out to the group about your personal identity or what you're learning. It's a really wonderful balance of being able to internalize what's being learned and share among people who you're comfortable with. And what I really loved about it as well is that I think oftentimes people hesitate to come to workshops about cultural heritage or race or ethnicity, especially if they feel like, you know what do I have to bring to this conversation? I'm among, you know, this, you know, I'm white, why I have no cultural heritage. And what she really tries to unpack is that we all bring a cultural heritage and a mosaic of backgrounds and identities. And whether you're a mother or a sister or Native American or LGBT, all of those identities make up our community. And she helps provide an opportunity to appreciate and understand your own identity, what parts of your identity are more or less important to you, and why it is that some are more important. Some are brought to the surface because we feel unsafe in certain situations. Some are brought to the surface because we have a huge amount of pride for that part of our identity. And she does a good job of highlighting that in each of us and giving us the opportunity to share a little bit about ourselves in that way and have some more personal appreciation as well as learning about others.
Iris, thank you so much for letting us know, and we look forward to hearing more about your events.
Thanks so much for having us.
That was Iris Mahdi Gibson, and I just was recalling that she stepped up to run for city council the same time you did, Dan, and they were excellent. You're all excellent candidates, and it just kind of illustrates that there are many opportunities for people to step up and become involved in their community. I'm regretting that She doesn't seem like she's going to run, but she would make an excellent city council person.
But she's on the Planning Commission, and she'll come on soon about that. But I did want to say very quickly, if you're interested in those events that the Whatcom Dispute Resolution Center is hosting, one is Saturday, May 20th, 1 to 4 at Pioneer Pavilion Center in Ferndale, and one is the 27th in Maple Falls. And you can go to the Whatcom Dispute Resolution Center and learn more about it. That is all the time we have. This is Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris. Thanks, Devlin, and we are out.